The following audio is brought to you by Emmanuel Baptist Church in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. More information about our church can be found at emmanueltuscaloosa.org.
Hebrews 9:15-22. Therefore, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance. Since a death has occurred that redeems them from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. For where a will is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. For a will takes effect only at death, since it is not in force as long as the one who made it is alive. Therefore, not even the first covenant was inaugurated without blood. For when every commandment of the law had been declared by Moses to all the people, he took the blood of calves and goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant that God commanded for you." And in the same way he sprinkled with the blood both the tent and all the vessels used in worship. Indeed, under the law, almost everything is purified with blood, and without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins.
How do you communicate a promise? You're talking to my kids, they're going to make you pinky swear. They're going to hold up their pinky. You promise? And of course, you got to extend your pinky and wrap it around theirs and say, "I promise." When I was a kid, I've used this example a number of times. We said, "Cross my heart, hope to die, and if you want to be really serious, stick a needle in my eye." There's a common one that we always referred to when we were kids, though I never did it because it's super weird, is a blood brothers pact, you know, where you cut your hand and you shake hands with one another. Communicates your seriousness to the covenant. All those forms of promise are forms of covenant making. And all of them, if you really stop to think about them, all of them are gory. Cross my heart, hope to die, stick a needle in my eye. Ugh, it's gory. A pinky promise is basically saying, if I break my promise, you can cut off my pinky. That's what that means. Blood brothers pact is, my very life is in your hands. It's at stake if I break this promise. All of them are essentially putting blood, putting your life on the line for this pact. That's what's happening there. The text that we're in this morning is heavy. In covenant language, everything in it is depicting a covenant and what a covenant is. It's describing it. And he's relating our previous knowledge of a covenant to what's happened here in Christ. And everything within this covenant language all has associations with blood and with death. And it's super confusing. Hard to understand and wrap your mind around, but in the end, the goal, if you take a step back from the passage, the goal is really to help you understand what Christ has actually done in his sacrificial death and why it's so vitally important that he died. Last week, we saw that Jesus didn't just come, as maybe our culture might say, to teach us how to live, or to show us the way, or to show us how to love, or some kind of, you know, hippy-dippy kind of thing like that. He actually came to stand between a holy God and sinful humanity as a mediator. He came to install a new covenant and stand in between a holy God and sinful man and reconcile the two. Sinful humanity and a holy God by his death, so that, as he goes on to say in the first half of verse 15, so that those who are called might receive an eternal inheritance. So in other words, what he's saying there at the first half of 15 is that Christ didn't just die to make salvation possible. He died to secure a reality, to actually make it a real thing and for his people. But this morning, as we move into the second half of verse 15 and on through verse 22, we've got to ask the question, but why death? Why did he have to die? And you might say, I get it that it was Jesus. And I get that he came to save us, reconcile us to God, and all of that. But why was this gory death the way that salvation had to come? And also, as a second part of that question, why is it that I have to believe in it to be saved? That seems so strange. Why is it that just putting my faith in it is what saves me? These are questions that we have to tackle this morning, and the passage that we're looking at has the potential to be incredibly confusing, and that's for a number of reasons. One is because we have a general lack of familiarity with covenants. We don't tend to think about them much during our day, and we probably, maybe not as much as we should, and we probably don't tend to make them nearly as much as they did back then. But there's also, in this passage, there's debates over how verses should be translated and how they should be interpreted, which also adds to the confusion. It doesn't help me at in any way, all right? And so in addition to those debates, there's arguments over what precisely the author means in this passage. And to be honest with you, I'm just being completely transparent for just a second. I could probably be persuaded of a different opinion, right? This is not one that you have to walk away and go, I am steadfast on this side versus the other side. I'm going to take one view, but I could be persuaded of another. In figuring out how to unpack all of that this morning, I thought maybe the best place was to start with a couple of fixed principles. Things that you just have to know. You just have to write down, or if you're a writer, or just tattoo them in your mind if you've got a photographic memory. Two principles that I think might help us understand covenants in the rest of this passage. The first principle is this. All covenants are ratified with blood. All covenants are ratified with blood. Ratified is what you say about covenants. Okay, I'm not trying to throw in a $5 word there. Ratified just means begun. All covenants are ratified or begun with blood. If we go back in the Old Testament to the covenant that God makes with Abraham, he, in Genesis chapter 15, he says this, and this is maybe when you read it, it comes across as a very weird passage, but essentially what's happening here is he's beginning a new covenant. And he says this in chapter 15, verses 9 to 10. He said to him, bring me a heifer 3 years old, a female goat 3 years old, a ram 3 years old, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. And he brought him all these, cut them in half, and laid each half over against the other. But he did not cut the birds in half. Genesis chapter 15, verse 17. This is just seven verses later. When the sun had gone down and it was dark, behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. So here are these animals. They're cut in half long ways, and they're laid on the ground against each other, and there's a little walkway in between. And in the middle of the night, here is Abraham seeing this vision of a smoking fire pot. He can't see God, but he comes to understand that this fire pot is representative of God, passing in between these pieces. Very strange. Then there's the covenant of marriage. We think about the covenant of marriage. So we have the covenant of Abraham. There's blood that's involved. There's sacrifices that are involved, designed to communicate a new covenant. There's the covenant of marriage. And it is sealed not at the altar where each one pledges, I do, but it actually sealed on the honeymoon where the marriage is consummated. And what is the product, the expected product of a marriage in a perfect world, in a perfect situation, but a child who is the symbol of that covenant between man and wife, where the two have become one flesh, and the symbol of their union is a child who is the mix of the father and mother's blood. It's a covenant depicted there in our children. So that's principle number one. All covenants are ratified with blood. Principle number two, when a covenant is broken, the covenant breaker is put to death. When a covenant is broken, the covenant breaker is put to death. Adam and Eve be a first example of this. Genesis 2, verse 17, God tells them, "But of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day you eat of it, you shall surely die." So he tells them very clearly in this covenant, and he doesn't have to kill an animal on the front end. This is before sin's entered the world. But he says to them, if sin does enter the world because you have disobeyed my command, what is going to be the result of your breaking the covenant? Death is on the line. And then we have the example of the Mosaic covenant. When God lays out the laws of what they would do to obey him, he says this in Deuteronomy 28, verse 15. But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord your God, or be careful to do all his commandments and his statutes that I command you today, then all these curses shall come upon you and overtake you. So what is the result of their disobedience to the covenant? If they break the covenant, it's very clear death is on the line. Your very life is at stake in your obedience to this covenant. So here's the only point that I'm going to make today. This is the main point of this passage. Jesus' death is necessary for our redemption. Jesus' death is necessary for our redemption. That is, if you read verses 16 to 22, regardless of how you understand the language, regardless of the translation, regardless of how complex all of the images are that are present there in those verses, the point that he is attempting to prove to you is that Jesus' death is necessary for our redemption. Look at the second half of verse 15, which is where that point comes from. Since a death has occurred that redeems them from the transgression committed under the first covenant. Death has occurred and it redeems them from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. It's a normal question to ask. Why is it that Jesus had to die? Why is it necessary that Jesus die in order to save God's people? Now, if you grow up in the church from the time you're a little kid, you are very used to hearing of Jesus' sacrifice. You're used to hearing animal sacrifice. You're used to hearing the words atonement. You're used to hearing the words sin and pardon and all of these Christian buzzwords that if you were to take a step back would seem very strange to the uninitiated. If there's somebody that comes in to the church just visiting and for the first time has never heard the gospel before, has never read the Bible before, has never heard any of this stuff before, to hear that the Son of God died in your place would seem odd. I don't get it. Why does he need to die? And I'm sure if you as a Christian were, you know, taken to coffee after the church with this kind of uninitiated person and they were to sit across from you at the coffee table, they might say to you, I still don't get it. But why did Jesus have to die? And maybe even the person that grew up in the church would go, I mean, I don't know. Because that's what God said, I guess. He had to die. So when it comes down to it, it's a challenging question to really wrap our minds around. But the author of Hebrews is not going to say, because God said so. He's going to give you the exact explanation of why it was that Jesus had to die. He's going to give you details of why this way was necessary. Now, without getting too much into the weeds here, if you look at verses 16 and 17, you can see that twice there, once in each verse, the word will is used. Everybody see that? See the word will used there in verse 16 and verse 17, particularly if you have the ESV, maybe a few other translations. We'll read it. He says in verse 16, "For where a will is involved, the death of the one who made it must be established. For a will takes effect only at death, since it is not in force as long as the one who made it is alive." So you see that word will that appears there. What you don't see is that the word that's translated will is the exact same word that's translated covenant everywhere else in Hebrews. So basically, every time you see the word covenant in Hebrews, it's that same word that here, for whatever reason, only in these two verses, in all of Hebrews, is translated will instead of covenant. So, the difference between a will and a covenant, though, is actually quite a lot. And it sort of changes the way that you read and understand these two verses. So, remember last week, I defined what a covenant was. A covenant is a formal agreement that defines a relationship between two parties. So a covenant is God taking his people and saying, this is how we are going to relate to one another. Okay? Now, a will is something that we actually do understand and we make all the time. A will is a legal document in which someone declares what's going to happen to their possessions. And that's usually upon death. Most frequently, it's upon death. There are some exceptions. So, it changes the way we look at this, because what is he saying about Christ's death? Is he saying to us that Christ died and his death as a last will and testament opens for us all the rewards now that come on the back end of Christ dying? That would be what a will is. And that's certainly true. We have a lot of rewards that we get because of Christ willing them to us, right? But is that what he's saying here? That's certainly what he says in a lot of other places in the Bible, but is that what he's saying here? There's a lot of debate back and forth about whether or not verses 16 and 17 should be translated will or should be translated covenant. But you can see the side that the ESV translators take on this, but if you had the New American Standard Bible, it would say covenant instead of will. So which is it? I am of the opinion that it should be covenant throughout, and I would be happy to stand back there at the doorway after the service is over and answer any question that I can, or talk to any of you after it's over about all the finer points of why I take that position. But in the end, when it comes to the application of this passage, it doesn't make a ton of difference one way or the other. But it does make a difference as to how we read it and how we understand what he's saying here. And so you can see here in verse 17 why some people think that he means will. If you read the ESV translation, he seems to be talking about a kind of legal document that takes effect after death. He says, "For a will takes effect only at death, since it is not in force as long as the one who made it is alive." I understand that. That sounds just like a will. But I think a more helpful way of translating verses 16 and 17 actually get to what he's saying here. So if we were to look at verse 16, I think it would sound something like this if you were to translate it literally. "For where there is a covenant, it is necessary that the death of the covenant maker be brought." Let me read that again. For where there is a covenant, it is necessary that the death of the covenant maker be brought. What he's helping us to understand in this verse is that when a covenant is made, the one making the covenant has to ratify it by blood. He has to lay his life on the line for the covenant. And he's not necessarily bringing his own death directly into the covenant. That would defeat the purpose of a covenant if one of the parties was dead. But he's bringing a substitute for himself. And he's laying the two against each other, and he's saying, this be me if I break this covenant. So go back to the illustration of God with Abraham. When he takes the animals and he cuts them in two and he lays them against each other. And God walks between the animals with a smoking fire pot. What he's saying to Abraham in this covenant ceremony is, so be me like these animals if I don't fulfill my end of the covenant. Well, with Abraham, he's making a one-sided promise. I'm going to do this. Through you, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. And what we're going to see later on is that he actually does fulfill it by his death. So he's walking between these two pieces, bringing, as the covenant maker, his own death in the substitution of these animals, the representation of these animals being slaughtered. So verse 17 literally says, for a covenant is valid upon dead ones. Not necessarily persons. I think he's talking about the sacrifice there. A covenant is valid upon dead ones, since it never has force when the one who made it is living. Meaning that if he goes on living and has not his life on the line, the covenant is not in force. It has no power behind it. So the death of the covenant maker's representative there in those animals essentially inaugurates the covenant relationship. In other words, what God is doing when he makes a covenant with his people is he's making a blood oath with his people. He's putting his life on the line to swear by it, essentially. And in some covenants, he's putting your life on the line too. When God makes a covenant with his people, he establishes the terms. And after Eden, the terms always involve blood. So at the beginning of the covenant, the blood representative is shed to essentially inaugurate the covenant. And then at the end, if the covenant is broken, then the blood of the covenant breaker is demanded. You have to die because you've broken the covenant. So if you think about it, blood in a covenant is like bookends. It sits around the covenant like this. It brackets the covenant in. On the front end, it seals it. It says, this is how the covenant is going to begin. This is what's required. This is what is at stake. And on the back end, if you break this covenant, you die. You become like these animals. So when we ask the question, why is it that Jesus had to die? The first answer to the question is obvious. His death was necessary to ratify the new covenant. His death was necessary in order to kick off, to inaugurate the new covenant. It was a new covenant in his blood. The blood that he shed at Calvary was the blood that put the new covenant into effect. It had to be that way because that's how covenants work. But then he's going to explain to us that that's not just how the new covenant works. That's actually how the old covenant worked as well. Look at verse 18. Therefore, not even the first covenant was inaugurated without blood. For when every commandment of the law had been declared by Moses to all the people, he took the blood of calves and goats, with water and scarlet and wool and hyssop, and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, this is the blood of the covenant that God commanded for you. And in the same way, he sprinkled with blood both the tent and all the vessels used in worship. He's making a reference back to Exodus 24. Now, if you remember your timeline of Exodus, we haven't even studied the book of Exodus on Sunday morning at all, but we've referred to it enough times that I think we can probably keep track in our minds. If you remember, that's Exodus 24 that he refers back to. But if you go back in Exodus to Exodus 19, remember that's the covenant ceremony. He's taken the people out of Egypt and he's brought them to the base of Mount Sinai. And there at the base of Mount Sinai, he is declaring to his people in Exodus 19 who he is to them and who they are to him. We are together in this. I'm making a covenant with you. We call that the Mosaic Covenant. In the very next chapter, in chapter 20, he gives to them the Ten Commandments. These are the rules. These are the laws that you must abide by. These are what we would call the stipulations of that covenant. This is what you must do, in other words. Then he goes through in several chapters, he lays out laws concerning altars, concerning slaves, concerning restitution, social justice, laws about the Sabbath, laws about festivals. And then he goes on to tell them in 23, you're going to go into the land of Canaan and you're going to take possession and you're going to judge all these people for their sin. Okay? So he has laid out for them essentially everything. All the stipulations of the covenant have been laid out for the people. But the way he inaugurates or ratifies the covenant is not with an oath. It's not with them taking their hand and placing it on the Ten Commandments and saying, yes, I hereby swear, I am telling the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. I will do everything within these Ten Commandments, so help me God. He doesn't make it swearable by that. It was by having blood of sacrifices sprinkled on the book itself, which contained all the stipulations of the covenant, and blood sprinkled on the people, which quite frankly is gross. And every single person in here is like, oh, thank you. I don't think I would want to be a part of that covenant ceremony. But it's important that all of the people are gathered there around Sinai and they're receiving a branch of hyssop dipped into a blood and water bowl and having the blood sprinkled on them. That's a lot of blood. And that's a lot of people who are all there at the base of Mount Sinai receiving blood in their faces at the time to basically consecrate them and make them part of the old covenant. Then he says later when the tabernacle's built, he's going to do the same thing there. He's going to take the tent that is the tabernacle, he's going to sprinkle blood on it. All the utensils that are used, he's going to sprinkle blood on it. And the point that he's making, he says plainly in verse 22, indeed, under the law, almost everything is purified with blood. So purification with blood is basically the way of cleansing it from the stain of sin. Everything in this world has the stain of sin on it. And if anything in this world is going to be set apart for the worship of a holy God, it needs to be purified, not with the death of this world, but with life that is in the blood. Tracking so far? Everything's got to be purified that way. And then if you go back into verse 7 of chapter 9, he says there about the high priest when he goes into the Holy of Holies once a year. He says, and not without taking blood, which he offers for himself and for the unintentional sins of the people. So the high priest even there is taking blood and it is cleansing him from the stain of sin. And all the people in that covenant ceremony are being ritually cleansed. So those who are dead in sin are being given life as symbolized by the blood of these animals under the covenant. However, the covenant is also ratified this way because it's a sign of inclusion. The reason the people are sprinkled is not just because they're sinful. It certainly is that. But the Egyptians were not sprinkled with blood. The Babylonians were not sprinkled with blood. The Canaanites were not sprinkled with blood. The Jebusites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, none of them were sprinkled with blood. The reason is because they're not included in the covenant. I know that sounds obvious, but it's true and it needs to be stated. The sprinkling of blood includes them in the covenant. It's a sign of their inclusion. So all of the things then that are, stop me if you've heard this before, washed in the blood are included in the covenant. Everything that is covered under the blood are also bound by its stipulations. So why is the covenant ratified with blood? He answers that at the last half of 22. He says, without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. When I started this, I laid out two principles that I wanted you to keep in mind. I don't know if we can put those back up on the screen, but if we can, let's do it. Principle one, all covenants are ratified with blood. And principle two, when a covenant is broken, the covenant breaker is put to death. Why is it blood? Why is it blood that cleanses and ratifies? And the simple answer is that blood is also a symbol of what happens to the covenant violator. This is the definition of sin, if you want to be accurate about it. Sin is a violation of the stipulations of the covenant. So all the people covered under the blood of the sacrifice during the covenant ratification ceremony are basically saying, this will be us. The fate of these animals that are now sprinkled on us, that will be our fate should we violate the stipulations of this covenant. That's why it's blood. Life is on the line. Going back to the very beginning of this sermon, the kinds of oaths that we take, cross my heart, hope to die, stick a needle in my eye, blood is invoked. Cut my hand, shake on it, blood is invoked. Cut off my pinky, should I lie to you? Blood is invoked. My life is put on the line. Unless your life is put on the line, there's no stakes in the covenant. So the reason why it's blood is because it symbolizes your life. This will be us if we don't fulfill the stipulations of this covenant. So then, the wages of sin, violation to the covenant, is what? Under the old covenant, God was gracious. There was provisions that he made because he knew his people could not keep the stipulations of the covenant. So there were provisions that he made for his people. And that was animal sacrifice. In other words, something had to die for their sins. Always, 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 there is communication to them. If you break the covenant, something is going to die. Something is going to lose its life. But as we've seen up to this point, those animal sacrifices didn't restore them in any way to a pre-fall relationship with God, did it? That's what we've seen in all of chapter 9 and really even chapter 8. All those animal sacrifices had no way of actually restoring the relationship with God. It simply staved off judgment. And it served to remind them, you're bound to this covenant with God. And every time you sin, an animal is going to die as a result of it. Well, that's a very clear picture that's being painted for you, isn't it? Every time I'm sinning, here's my sin, and it's laid on some goat. And that poor goat loses his life for all of my sins. It serves as a stark reminder that I have to fulfill my end of the obligation, and if I don't, I'm going to end up suffering the fate of these animals. So for a time, God was willing to allow his people to pay their debt to the covenant through animal sacrifice. But the problem, of course, is obvious. That under the old covenant, I could never fulfill the stipulations of that covenant. And at some point, at any point God chose, if he called the debt, I would be up a creek. I would be in trouble. See, it's fine as long as he's allowing me to continue to bring animals. But should he ever decide, because at some point he's got to, judgment has to be invoked on all covenant breakers, I'm in that group. And no animal is going to restore that relationship between me and God if he calls the debt. So in answer to the question, why did Jesus have to die? The first answer we came to is Jesus' death inaugurated the new covenant. It's how covenants are ratified, by blood. And his blood was the ratification, the inauguration of the new covenant. But perhaps just as important, Jesus' blood closed the old covenant. Jesus' blood closed the old covenant. See, what happened is, at Calvary, God called the debt. Everything that my people owe me in all of their covenant breaking, I am now calling the debt. All of my wrath is going to be poured out now on my people for all their covenant violations. When the Bible says that the Son of God took on flesh, it's not merely a poetic way of describing the incarnation of Jesus. It's saying that God Himself, in the person of the Son, took on the very nature of the covenant breaker so that he might suffer the punishment of the debt that God was calling. Who would do that? No one. All of humanity is lumped into this one massive pool of wickedness. And everyone there has a debt that is only going to be paid by the wrath of God for covenant violation. Who on earth that stands apart from humanity is going to say, I'll join that group. I'll take on flesh. I'll go into that pool. I'll suffer the consequences of covenant violation. No one would do that if given the choice. What Jesus is doing by taking on flesh, again, not merely a poetic way of describing the incarnation, it's saying he actually took on the role of a covenant breaker even though he had no sin. Jesus came in as a Jewish man born under the law, under the old covenant. So, and his fate was to suffer as a covenant breaker, but as a sinless man, one who never violated the covenant, he suffered the fate as though he had, in the place of all the covenant breakers. There's a scene in the Gospel of John. Right before Jesus goes to the cross, they're at the Last Supper, and Jesus kneels in front of Peter. He's got no shirt on. He's got a towel wrapped around his waist. He's got a basin at Peter's feet, and he's going to wash Peter's feet. And the disciples, especially Peter, are having none of it. Peter says this in John 13, verses 6 to 8. Lord, do you wash my feet? Jesus answered him, what I am doing you do not understand now. Afterward, you will understand. Peter said to him, you shall never wash my feet. Jesus answered him, if I do not wash you, you have no share with me. Jesus is using the washing of the disciples' feet as a symbolic reference to the washing of his blood that is about to come at the inauguration of the new covenant. Do you hear that? That's covenant language that Jesus is using there in the washing of Peter's feet. He's saying, if I don't wash you, in other words, if you're not in the ratifying of this new covenant, when the blood is sprinkled on you, if I don't wash you, you don't have a share in this new covenant. You don't have a share with me. He's telling people that his service to his people is to ceremonially cleanse them with his blood, both by taking on all the curses of the old covenant that they deserve. I'm going to wash you and cleanse you from all the sins under the old covenant. That's what I'm going to do. But then I'm going to inaugurate a new covenant. I'm going to wash you by including you in this covenant, just like at the base of Mount Sinai all those years before. So that God's covenant people will always be secured. Now, go into our passage. Look at chapter 9. Go up to verse 11 through 14. Listen to what he's saying here. But when Christ appeared as high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is not of this creation, he entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of the blood of goats and calves, but by means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the sprinkling of defiled persons with the ashes of a heifer sanctify for the purification of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God? See, the point that he's making here is that the blood of bulls and goats were sprinkled on the people, they were sprinkled on the tabernacle, they were sprinkled on all the utensils. It was a way of ratifying the old covenant, and it purified their flesh so that they could serve God, but it did it for that long. What would then happen if the people who God is calling were not sprinkled with the blood of goats and calves, but were sprinkled with the blood of the Son of God? How much more would they be purified? They would not only be purified in flesh, but they would be purified all the way down. What if he then, instead of going to the tabernacle and sprinkling the blood of goats and calves on the tabernacle and cleaning the utensils with the blood of animals, went to God himself in the heavenly tabernacle and laid his own blood at his feet? How much more would the people of God be purified? What kind of cleansing would that provide the people? Why did Christ have to die? The answer is so that I could be included in the people of God. Listen, I know a lot of that is technical and very difficult to walk through in terms of covenants, and it's something we don't think about a lot. And maybe your mind's being stretched a little bit, or maybe you've gone, I'll say, okay, I'm not really tracking, but okay, fine. This is a radical revelation. What he's saying here is radical when you see it. If you come to the gospel and you understand the concept of covenant, you not only see why Christ had to die, but you gain a confidence in your standing within the covenant. Jesus didn't literally sprinkle you, right? That's maybe a hard part. Moses dipped the little branch in there and he sprinkled the people with blood, but I don't see anything in Acts where Jesus sprinkled his blood on the disciples, and I certainly didn't get sprinkled with any blood. I haven't met Jesus physically in that sense. But what he does do, he promises to us in the new covenant in Ezekiel 36:25-27. He says this, this is the promise of the new covenant. This is in the Old Testament. I will sprinkle clean water on you. You hear that? That's covenant. That's Sinai, the sprinkling of clean water. I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you shall be clean from all your uncleannesses and from all your idols. I will cleanse you, and I will give you a new heart, and a new spirit I will put within you, and I will remove the heart of stone from your flesh and give you a heart of flesh, and I will put my spirit within you. And what does he say? Cause you to walk in my statutes and be careful to obey my rules. Do you hear the covenant ceremony language that he's giving you here. Ezekiel is actually using covenant language from Sinai and saying the new covenant is going to be ratified in the same way, but he's going to do it in a slightly different way. He's going to sprinkle you so clean, and he's going to put his spirit within you that the stipulations of the covenant, you're going to want to obey. You're going to desire to obey. That's how you know that you're a part of the new covenant community, that you have the Spirit of God living in you. When we say that you're saved by grace through faith, what we mean is the faith that you demonstrate is an outward sign that you have been cleansed inwardly by God at the covenant ceremony. When Christ died, he set apart his people as inaugurating the new covenant. He sprinkled clean water on them. He put his Holy Spirit within them and caused them to walk by his statutes. So if you look at your life and you see yourself as being convicted of sin, as being brought to repentance, desiring to grow in faith, to grow in the love of God that saved you, then you're included in the new covenant. And if he has included you in the new covenant, if he sprinkled you with the blood of Christ, the covenant stipulations, the covenant consequences have already been paid. So in the new covenant, what is radically different is that Christ came in as a once-for-all sacrifice. So he inaugurated the new covenant and he closed it at the same time. He became the sacrifice on the front end and the back end. He inaugurated a new people, and he paid for all the consequences of the old. So now I'm included in the blood of Christ. I have his spirit within me. I'm growing in the love of Christ. And I have no consequences to pay because my Savior paid for them all. When you come to understand those realities, when he says, those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance. And when he says he redeems them from their transgressions committed under the first covenant, he's talking about you. And there's no covenant curses to pay. There's nothing that you can do to earn that either. There's nothing you can do to fulfill the old covenant. It can't be done by you because it was already done by Christ. The sprinkling of the new covenant water that cleanses you can also not be done by you. That also is done by Christ. The only thing that you can do if you are included in the new covenant is say, thank you, God, for saving me. You're not clinging to performance. You're clinging to a covenant that's sealed by the blood of Christ.
Thanks for listening. If you live in the Tuscaloosa area and are looking for a church, we'd love for you to visit. Our service times are Sunday mornings at 10:30 and Wednesday nights at 6:15.